This is tape number 5 of an interview with Dr. Clinton N. Woolsey, Professor Emeritus of Neurophysiology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. This portion of the interview was conducted in Dr. Woolsey's office at the Weissman Center on March 4, 1982, by Calvin Pierce. I guess you can tell me then a little of your background about the Weissman Center.
Well, let's go back a second. Say sure. We moved into the new medical sciences building when it was constructed in 1960, and we all may have already mentioned this, but it was then that the neurophysiology group, who were up until then members of the Department of Physiology, were established as an independent research facility. And my job as director of the group was to be responsible directly to the dean. So that happened in 1960, and that's the time when Jersey Rose arrived in Madison. And so we moved from our old quarters in the Service Memorial Institute into the new quarters that we'd helped design in the Medical Sciences building on the second floor. So we continued there until the plans for the Weissman Center were being developed. The Weissman Center was one of perhaps 10 or 11 institutes which were established in relation to the problems of mental retardation in various universities within the country. We were not the first, but we were not the last either. And there was a committee which had membership from departments which they hoped would have some contribution to make to the center. And this committee met and came up finally with plans for the center, including the details of the, we were consulted in terms of the people, especially the people who were to move out here, were consulted by the architects in terms of designing the space which was to be assigned to them. That was probably taking place in the...
Here?
The Weissman Center opened in somewhere around March 1973. That means the building had been completed and ready to be moved into. So, but I continued as chairman of neurophysiology, or head of the neurophysiology research unit. It was called the Laboratory of Neurophysiology, until I reached retirement, which was in end of June of 75. So I was still ahead of the group after I came out here.
Was the were there quite a number of people besides yourself helping plan the Weissman Center?
Oh yes, there were people from all the departments, which ultimately there must have been 15 to 20 people on that committee.
And what about its namesake, Dr. Weissman?
He was on the committee too. He was still living at the time the plans were made. Hmm. In fact, he was to be head of the neurochemistry section, which is down the, his office was the room down the, where the secretary now is, where Carol is. That was his office. That was to be his office. But he never got in here because he died just at the, as we were about to open.
Was the center following probably in the same path as the earlier McArdle and clinical oncology programs in terms of getting more basic research institutions going at the university?
Well, this was a national program, which is different from the McArdle. That was a local that was something that developed out of the local interest in cancer. But this was a nationwide thing which had been initiated by President Kennedy when he was president. He had a sister who was actually probably still in a mental retardation center here in Wisconsin. And he very readily supported the notion of having research institutes developed in various places in the country to deal with the problem of mental retardation. And it was understood that that should include not only the study of the mentally retarded, but the various basic sciences which related to the problems of mental retardation. That meant psychology, physiology, pharmacology, chemistry, and so on, as well as clinical aspects of the disorder. It also meant that there needed to be a school, particularly for training people in which on how to handle the problems of mental retardation. So that, but that was not simple. That was not something that was elaborated just for Wisconsin. Mm. But there are a number of others. One is at UCLA. There's one at in Tennessee. There's another in New York City, at the Einstein. There's one at Harvard. There's one at Hopkins. There are a variety of these. I don't know where. And there was one at Cincinnati.
So federal funding certainly was important then.
That was the whole. Yes, it would not have happened without that.
Hmm. And the physiologists here on campus now have somewhat split. There's some of you are here, and some of you are still over at the old hospital building.
Well, the neurophysiology group, we never called it, thought of it splitting. Mm-hmm. Everybody who came over here had a connection with some department in other parts, situated elsewhere on the campus. There was only one department which has just now moved out of here, mm-hmm. which was fully in this place. That was the, I've forgotten what it was called, but it was down on the second floor.
Mm-hmm.
And they've now moved over to the, what used to be the, or was the, University Club.
Was there a tendency for the people who, with more, doing research that might be more clinically oriented to come over here? And
well, there were, that was true only for those that were dealing with clinical material, as
yeah.
people down on the first four floors are. But the people on this floor and the floor above and even in the floor just below us in the psychology section, they probably deal with children down there, and so theirs is more related, but ours deals with basic sciences, and we don't deal with patients in any way, nor do the people on the, in upstairs in the endocrinology section. But this was not a question of splitting. It was a question of whether the existing departments, which had an interest in mental retardation and the basic sciences related to the brain, whether they were willing to come out and participate. And there was some advantage when we got we've got all this extra space, you see, that on this half of this floor. We came to neurophysiology. We had animal quarters above. We had there's an electronic shop here. There's a mechanic shop downstairs. There's a computing. All of this was very important to the work of neurophysiology, and I think we've stuck pretty close contact with our colleagues in who didn't come over here, perhaps more so than some other departments have, but I'm not sure about that. At least we've never noticed any splitting of any kind. That as we move back and forth, we have conferences over there, we have others over here.
Were you still all members then of the Laboratory of Neurophysiology?
When we came over here, yes, and then then in when I was approaching the retirement age of 70, which meant July the 1st of 1975. My birthday is the end of November, last day of November, and so I was 70 in 1974. But the retirement comes within the June the 1st following, or November, June the 30th of the year following the time you reach the retirement age. And we had within our group people who had come from physiology, but there were others who'd been trained primarily in anatomy, others primarily in psychology, some were in electrical engineering, and it raised the question in my mind as to what might be the future of this group of 10 or 12 people once I ceased to be the director of the neurophysiology group and laboratory. And so we talked it over among ourselves and then went to the dean to raise the question of the possibility of becoming a department of neurophysiology, and rather than going back, splitting up and going back into other departments, because I had the feeling that it would not be continued as a laboratory of neurophysiology, because that was the response to my situation as a special professor in the graduate school. And
was there any university concern that the faculty involved in the laboratory should have an affiliation with the department rather than being simply researchers in the laboratory? Someone mentioned that.
In what department? Physiology?
Yes, that they that there should not be faculty who don't have a department status.
Well, I never heard about that, because we did not suggest. See, it was the executive committee of the medical faculty which suggested that neurophysiology be established as a laboratory of neurophysiology. That was not our department. It was not the neurophysiologist who suggested that. And that went through the executive committee of the medical school, and while I was director of the laboratory of neurophysiology, I sat on the executive committee of the medical school. So I was in a position when it came time to suggest departmental status to make that suggestion while I was sitting on the committee, and then they appointed a special committee to consider it, and finally it came through with a proposal of such establishment of such a department. It's the only department of neurophysiology in the United States. There are other departments that deal with the nervous system called neuroscience departments or neurobiology departments, but I think we're the only one that's called a neurophysiology. In a country like Japan, it's quite common to have a separate department for neuroscience and the rest of physiology. I don't know why this developed, except that the methods and techniques used in neurophysiology have become so highly elaborate in recent years that they are not regular physiology departments don't usually provide the facilities for such things.
Have the scientists in your laboratory then each been members also of a department before the Department of Neurophysiology was begun?
It depends on what you mean by that. If it's a question whether they were tenured faculty, some were and some were not. Some were on the tenure track, some were not. I think most of the people, Dr. Rose came, I don't think he was ever a member of the Department of Physiology, because we were already established as a laboratory of neurophysiology. But he was given a full professorship, nevertheless, and he was called Professor of Neurophysiology. That appointment was approved by the medical faculty. I think Benjamin and Hind and Welker also were full-time people, so was Geisler. Many of those were then associate professor, or perhaps even lower down the list, I've forgotten. I'd have to go back and look that up somehow.
No, you don't remember any medical school people being concerned about this question of having a department that each person is attached to that was a reason for setting up a department of neurophysiology? No,
I don't. Have any. And not everybody in the neurophysiology group. In fact, from the beginning, when I first came, I was, as I think I told you, I was told both by the dean of the graduate school and by the dean of the medical school, I mean Middleton of the medical school and Elvium of the graduate school, although Elvium wasn't. Yes, he was. He was dean of the graduate school. Told me that I was not to be allow myself to be involved with the teaching curriculum of the medical school. That I was to devote my time to research and establishing research programs, and to dealing with graduate students and postdoctoral fellows, training them to do research. But since I needed an assistant to handle in anatomical aspects, they had agreed to that I could ask Dr. Rose to come out and join me here. And one of his functions would have been to work with me on the anatomical aspects of research, and to be involved with the teaching of physiology to the medical students. It would be about half and half. He couldn't come, but we got another chap by the name of Barnard. He did, and he took part, John Barnard, B-A-R-N-A-R-D. And John handled the teaching for several years when he had a chance to leave and went down to the University of Illinois to what seemed to be a better job. But as I've mentioned, that he was, when he got there, he found he couldn't pass the physical exam to qualify him for insurance and tenure position, so he left there and went to Marquette, where he could, and died a couple of years later. Dr. Ockert then came, and he had worked with Jersey Rose in Baltimore, and he was here for several years until about, well, he was here when we became a laboratory of neurophysiology, but that year he went to anatomy department as an associate professor because they needed someone to teach neuroanatomy. And I don't know how many years he was here, for at least four, before he was invited back to Switzerland, where he now heads the Department of Physiology and the Brain Research Institute there. So that Bob Benjamin then took over the teaching role for the medical school. But until later, Berman, who is here with us now and is now a member of neurophysiology and had been, after Ockert left, Berman went to the anatomy department to act as the neuroanatomist, be there in charge of the teaching. He's still active in the teaching program. But he came back to neurophysiology and has been stationed out here part-time.
Well, the department was founded in 75, you said.
75.
How has it been doing in the years since then? Have things changed very significantly?
Not particularly. It's been doing very well.
Yeah.
It's about the same size in terms of staff. We've got, of course, Dr. Rose and I are both retired, but the names are still on the list as retired, but we've added two new people recently, assistant professor level. Most of the others are either full professors or some are associate professors.
I take it that you've been pretty active since your retirement.
Oh yeah, too active.
Seems like you're still doing a lot of work with the in the laboratory and writing up your data, and also the international stuff that you're still working on.
Still working on that. We've had those, the three volumes are out, well, but the third one should be out this month, but...
this was the symposium?
The symposium which we held in Dallas, Texas. And we, and as the last time you were here, or before that, we had put together the abstracts of the presentations that we made at the meeting in Shanghai, and those will be published in British, one of the British, in Britain.
Do you have any sense of the neurophysiology program here at Wisconsin following a research tradition that goes back through Johns Hopkins or even further back into the European tradition? Is there any continuity here that you feel is historically is involved?
Well, I think there is continuity in a sense that has been provided starting with Baltimore at least, and of course what goes back beyond that, there are many, many lines of research that do go back quite far. For example, the work we've done on the chimpanzee, which we've done a fair amount, in a way dates back to Sherrington's work on the chimpanzee. And that was done in the around 1907 is when they first published the first abstract and got it finally printed in 1917. But we came out here in 1948, having been influenced, of course, by Dr. Marion Hines in anatomy at Hopkins and by Dr. Bard, with whom we had closely worked. And so many of the lines of research that we had started there, such as work on the somatosensory cortex, the motor cortex, the visual, areas, we've continued those here, and the auditory system, we've continued those here, and of course, the biggest development which has occurred in neurophysiology here at Wisconsin has been the enormous development of research and its instrumentation, headed now by Dr. Hind, on the auditory system. I'd say more than half of the people in the department now are working on the auditory system. And others, like Dr. Welker, of course, who came to work with us early and became involved with studies on the somatosensory system, he's still working on that, including the cerebellum, which we also had been involved with. And so that's another line. And then Dr. Rose came out and brought a lot of his anatomical methodologies with him, and those have been incorporated into the work of the group. We also had an interest in the visual system, which we worked on here somewhat, not so much from Baltimore, but it began in Baltimore because Marshall and Talbot, whom I mentioned before, were the ones who first did the mapping of the visual areas in the cat brain and discovered the duality of these areas at that period. At the same time, we discovered the duality of the auditory system. And so that's another line of work which we've developed to some extent ourselves here, and which Dr. Montero now is following through with in quite a vigorous fashion.
A very complex set of relationships with former research and people and what's being done today. It's very hard to puzzle out all of the connections.
And of course, our interest in the human material, which we published recently in the paper, with Erickson, that notion originated in Baltimore. We brought it out here and persuaded Dr. Erickson to that we could work together on something there, and we finally got this paper out this last year, 2 years ago. That's a clinical connection which probably in a way dates back to my original thought of being a neurosurgeon. I've kept contact closely with, I probably know more neurosurgeons in the country than any other brand of surgeon or medical practitioner, because for many years I used to attend their scientific meetings and actually have been made honorary member of two of their organizations.
Hmm. Well, you've been active in neurophysiology now for quite a long time, about 50 years, and just in general terms, how do you see how our understanding of the organization of the nervous system has changed over that, as a half a century, if you compared our general picture of the brain as opposed to 50 years ago?
Well, let's see, when did we begin? Let's see, Claire. Yes, it was in this, just about this time of the year, a little earlier, a month earlier, in 1929, I began to work on the nervous system. And that's 53 years ago with Marion Hines. Well, in those days, there was a good deal of information existing on the organization, on the anatomy of the cerebral cortex, for example. There was relatively little information on the organization of the functional areas of the brain. We knew that there was a visual area, an auditory area, a somatosensory and a somatic motor area. We did not know that there was any more than one, and it wasn't until, it was about 12 years later that the duality concept arose concerning the somatosensory, visual, auditory areas. And there's gradually, since that time, been a growing number of areas recognized, so that within the last 10 years, with the development of the much finer exploration of the brain with microelectrodes, additional areas have been discovered. So as I've mentioned before, there are as many at least as more than a dozen visual areas, probably as many as 18 or 19, and there probably are comparable numbers of auditory areas. We know at least 8 or 10 in the cat, and there are not so many recognized somatosensory areas, but there are at least 4.
Seems like all of this work has certainly raised a lot more questions than maybe it has answered, and made things seem a lot more complicated than they were.
I think the brain is certainly much more complicated than it was originally thought to be, and now that they're dealing with the various chemical methods for working out the connectivities within the nervous system, especially in the cortex, but between the cortex and the thalamus and other parts of the brain, they're showing a much more detailed picture of the way the brain is put together, and this all has to be understood in order to understand how it's functioning. I think it's going to be many, many years before we know what all these many new areas are contributing to the function of the nervous system.
Generations, perhaps.
It could be generations, although I think most of the methods for studying them have now are probably available. You'll have to use anatomical techniques, physiological techniques for mapping and for studying connections. They can use the behaving animal with implanted electrodes to study the activity of cells in these different areas to see how the cells in the different areas of the brain perform under different circumstances. I think the, as I may have mentioned before, the farthest advanced in that direction perhaps is the work that has been done by a Japanese down at the University of in Washington University in St. Louis, Nobuo Suga, who has been studying the bat brain. And he has more information on how these many areas in the bat brain relate to the behavior of the bat than we have in any other animal, probably because the bat's behavior is obviously more complicated than the behavior of a cat is.
Excuse me, we've reached the end of the tape.
This is side B of tape number 5 of an interview with Dr. Clinton N. Woolsey, conducted on March 4th, 1982.
So are there any areas in the field that stand out in your mind as needing further research today that are particularly in question, that we need to understand more?
Oh, I think there's a many that that need. I think all areas. I think the whole. I don't think we have very much detailed information yet about the functions of any of these areas. What we've done mainly so far is to define them and show the relationship either to the sound spectrum or to the visual spectrum. Or to the body surface of the skin, and the kind of study that's going to tell us what these cells in these different areas are up to haven't yet been done sufficiently in, to give us an interpretation of the meaning of these areas.
Mm-hmm.
Some is going on in behaving animals, it's going to take quite a while. It's a difficult task.
Is there something, do you think there's something special about scientists who devote themselves to studying the brain and the nervous system? Are they different from other scientists?
Well, I don't think so. I don't know.
They're not, you don't think they ask questions that are different from the questions that general physiologists ask?
Well, they have to. They have to deal with a more complicated system, I suppose, than the cardiovascular system, for example. That pervades the whole body, of course, but it isn't quite as detailed as the neuroanatomical, neurophysiological aspects are. And of course, I think one direction that's going to have to go is in the direction of trying to figure out the relation of these various cortical areas to the mental life of the animal and to the individual, you see.
As opposed to just the sensory and motor functions.
That's right. And how are they contributing to the mental faculties of the individual? I don't think we know too much about that at all.
How do you feel about your own personal contribution to this area? Do you feel like you've played an important role in all of this? How would you weigh?
Well, I think we were very lucky to have appeared on the scene at the time when techniques for mapping the functions of the brain were being produced, and we were just lucky to get in on that. We started out to use the more ancient methods of taking out pieces of the brain and studying the defects, such as clinicians study the effect of damage to the nervous system. We could go in and make specific removals, but then this method of electrophysiology came along, and it, when I was a medical student, we heard nothing about electrophysiology, except maybe something about peripheral nerve action potentials. I remember speaking to, asking Erlanger, who, not Erlanger, but Gasser, who was a Wisconsin graduate, was one of the Nobel laureates. I asked him about early what he thought was the possibility of studying the central nervous system electrophysiologically, and he said he just thought it was just too complicated and couldn't be done very easily. Because what they've been doing was studying peripheral nerve action potentials, identifying the size of the fibers and relating the velocity of conduction in the fibers to the fiber size, and that was relative, because when they started to look at the spinal cord, the thing became very much more complicated. But as it turned out, when we began to just touch the skin and look at the response in the brain, it was a fairly simple looking thing, you see. Now,
well, the new techniques certainly were important then.
They were very important.
And given the new techniques and given the institutional support for this kind of research that was going, if Clinton Woolsey had never been around to do this, do you think we'd be doing the same things today?
I suppose somebody else might have done it. I don't know. Actually, this method of, these methods of mapping the brain that we got involved with early are very time-consuming. You have to work day and night sometimes on these problems. And the thing that surprises me is there haven't been more people who have either raised questions about one's work and therefore go out and repeat it. There haven't been too many repetitions of, if they repeat, they're more likely to do the same thing on another animal, you see. That has happened, and they usually get similar results, so there's nothing much to, there's not too much criticism in that. So that, I feel we've just been very lucky to, we've had the chance to work on the somatic, the auditory, some extent the visual, the motor system. The motor system, of course, the method we used there was quite old. That was electrical stimulation was applied to mapping the motor cortex as early as 1870. But what we did was to be more meticulous in the control of the strength of the stimulus and in raising the and trying to find the threshold values that would excite the motor areas in their different parts, and we thus were able to discover a portion of the motor cortex that hadn't been revealed before. But I think this is a matter of getting down to refinement of technique, which you're almost you're led into by simply by the nature of experiments as they progress. Why? You see there's something you have to do that you haven't nobody done yet or hadn't been done in with as much care as it should be, and so that's something you have to do.
Well, how has being a neurophysiologist affected your outlook on life? Would you say there has been such an...
Well, I as I said, I started out originally in expecting to be a neurosurgeon, and I think the thing that interests me in neurosurgery was the stimulus that I'd received from my college professor of psychology on the brain and some of its complicated functions. And I thought, if one's going to be a physician, maybe it would be nice to deal with that part of the body. And see what you can do in the way of diagnosis and treatment and so on, and that seemed more a likely way to go than dealing with clinical neurology, which was able to make diagnoses but never did anything very much. Now, of course, there are a lot of drugs that they can use, and that's changed the situation, but I think my interest in the nervous system has been much more stimulated probably by dealing with physiology than it would have been by being a neurosurgeon. So I think it's been a lot more interesting. We've got to know people all over the world, which we might have done to some degree as a neurosurgeon, but we've been a different class of people. But as it is, we know many of the leading scientists in most countries of the world.
How do you think that the general public, how much of this do you think the general public understands what's going on in neurophysiology today?
Well, I doubt if they understand too much of it. I don't know.
Yeah. It's a field that's maybe quite hard for outsiders to appreciate. But it certainly has a lot of interest. I think people in general, I think, find the brain and behavior very interesting because it seems to affect them.
I suppose that more people who go through universities take psychology courses and learn about things about the brain that way. I don't know to what extent the kinds of things that we've done get into the teaching, but I'm sure there must be some of it there because, well, many of our postdoctoral fellows have gone into the field of psychology. So they probably are teaching many of the things that we have gotten them interested in. But I don't know what the general public's interest in this would be.
Yeah. Well, it certainly...
I think they would think it's... I don't think there'd be too much trouble persuading the public that it's desirable to learn more about the nervous system and the brain because of the all recognized problems of the brain involves them in. There might be mental problems, there may be physical problems.
Well, it certainly has a, in terms of science policy, it remains one of the areas that has to compete for federal dollars and make its claim for support for basic research still going on.
I think we had a visit here just last week from someone from the NIH dealing with the mental retardation centers, and question I was interested in asking him had to do with the strength of support, that is to the feeling of on the part of the Institute for Research in the Basic Sciences. I said, after all, the sort of thing we do up here do not have an immediate and direct application to the problems of mental retardation. They are more concerned with understanding the organization and function of the brain, which of course is important for mental retardation, but what we do will not necessarily immediately have a direct application to the problems of mental retardation. In the long run, it should help understand the brain and perhaps make such a contribution. Well, he said they were fully convinced of the importance of the basic science research that goes on in institutions of this sort. And therefore, yes? Hello? Is it on now?
Yeah. He was saying he was convinced of the importance of basic
science. He was, yes. And so I think that they will, that we'll probably continue to get support. I don't know how.
There has been a tendency, though, I think recently to put more emphasis on practical research that seems to have immediate benefits, and I think the funding for basic science has actually dropped proportionally recently. I don't know what the effects of that will be in the long run.
I don't. Of course, there. I think there's been a growing emphasis of money being distributed to the applied sciences. In the beginning there wasn't too much of that because there wasn't too much research going on in the applied areas that that seemed to qualify for support. I suppose in a way the mental retardation centers themselves as a whole are applications of money to practical problems, but I think the importance of the statement which was made by this visitor was that even though that's the basic mission of the centers, they feel that it's very important that basic science that's relevant to the field be continued even as basic science, even though they don't see the immediate application of that to the problem, because before they can apply it, they have to understand the mechanism and so on, and it's going to take time to do that.
Hmm. Well,
I haven't had any feel. I think we've had a tremendous amount of support for basic science in the through the NIH, and while I'm sure that it's harder to get a grant now, there are also far more people applying for such grants. We've trained a tremendous number. Look at the numbers of, see the thickness of that, not that one, this one here.
What is this?
This is the membership directory of the Society for Neuroscience. How many, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. Well, there are about 60 per page, and there are 120 pages.
Hmm.
So 60, 120 times 60, that's 7,200.
It's a pretty big enterprise.
And those people are all dealing with research on the nervous system. Most of them will be basic scientists, not the clinical people.
Hmm.
There will be some clinical people will be members of the society, but most of those will be anatomists, physiologists, psychologists, but they're the people who are working in laboratories such as this group here.
Hmm.
I have a notion that there'll have to be a cutback in research. I don't know how that's going to come about, unless the economy recovers, but I think I don't know how they ever figure out. This is done by the individuals who decide to go into the field. Does there appear to be an opportunity to do something? And that has appeared to be possible up until the present now, with the economic conditions getting worse. It may prove more difficult for people to find jobs. That will naturally result in fewer people trying to get into a given area.
Mm-hmm.
And so there might be a drop-off in the next 10 years in the number of people involved with basic science.
What are your own plans for the future now?
Well, you saw these figurines I'm working on here on a goat. I've got this is a study which was done, as I mentioned, back in the 1950s, 1951. Just two animals we studied, but I'm going to report on those at the meeting in Lausanne next month. And we have a number of other studies for which we've collected the data and have never gotten around to working it up, working up the data. And we've already gotten started in that with this work, with this paper with Erickson on human, and with a paper we'll have in one of the volumes coming out on the auditory cortex of the monkey. And I think what I'll just do is keep on going through those files over there and digging out the material and converting them into papers. In fact, I even have a possibility of developing a monograph on the subject. This publishing the three volumes of the symposium has asked me to consider putting some of the stuff together and publishing it that way.
Looks like you have probably enough in those files to keep you busy for some time.
I think it could be done. I could probably keep busy till the age of 90.
Do you feel like taking a long vacation?
No, I never like take vacations very much. unless they're associated with going someplace to meet people and see where we're going, as I said, to Switzerland this next 3 weeks from today. And we'll be visiting colleagues whom we've known for some time.
Yeah.
So I think that's a nice part of science, the number of people you get to know in
various
parts of the world.
In some ways it's a very social activity.
There's a good deal of that going on.
And, you know, I think a lot of people think of scientists working alone in a laboratory. But,
well, they do that, but then they don't always do that all the time.
No. Well, I've been asking you a lot of questions for over the last few weeks. I don't know. What has it been like being asked all these questions and reviewing all of this? Do you feel like...
Well, I don't know whether we've got it all down or in the form that you'd like it or what it might look like when we see it. We'll take a look at it.
Yeah. Is there anything that you would have liked to have done differently if you could have in the past?
Oh, I don't think so.
Are you surprised at all at where you've ended up and what you're doing now? You could have foreseen it when you started out with it.
Well, I don't think people look... I don't know whether people look forward to what their expectations are in the future. You know, I think you go from day to day with the problems that are before you and try to solve them. And it's been very nice to come out to Wisconsin, but I think I would have enjoyed it very much just staying in Baltimore.
Yeah. I'm trying to think if there's anything we haven't touched on that we might want to mention.
Well, if you find that, we can get together again sometime if you feel like it.
Sure. This concludes the interview with Dr. Woolsey.